right, it is time for another episode of The Fifth Estate. My name is Jay Caruso. I am here with my co-host, Mr. Neil Dewing. How are you, sir?
Oh, I'm mostly recovered from the hurricane, doing okay. How about you, Jay?
Doing well, doing well. We didn't, you know, I live here in Atlanta, so we didn't get any of that. Maybe just, I think I had a strong wind knocked over the umbrella out on my deck. It was about as much as I saw, so, but, A lot of devastation from up and down the eastern seaboard there from that hurricane. So a lot of flooding and everything. So, but
same here. Yeah. Sadly, none of it threatened my life.
Oh darn! That's just awful. That is just awful. So
hey, folks, if you love this cheery upbeat podcast that we've got going on here, I want to just remind you, if you haven't already, please go ahead and subscribe. Whatever podcast listening service you prefer, iTunes, SoundCloud, the browser, who cares? As long as you're listening, we appreciate it. And if you do subscribe and you haven't yet, a review would be nice. Jay, don't we like reviews?
We love reviews. We love reviews. In fact, we had a reviewer we were talking about. We were trolling our next guest, specifically with the question that we have at the end. Our current guest, anyway.
That's right. That's right. It is an important question, as our listeners, our regular listeners, may recall. We have a series of unanswerable questions that Jay and I will never agree upon, and the latest is whether Die Hard is a Christmas movie. So stay tuned, because we have noted expert Sonny Bunch of the Washington Free Beacon here to address that very question. But before we get into that, we're going to get all intellectual on you. We're going to talk about the role of the critic. So I'd like to welcome Mr. Bunch. Sonny, hello.
Hi.
Thank you so much for being here with us tonight. Do want to talk about what you do for the Free Beacon and for the Washington Post as well. Isn't that correct?
I do write a weekly thing for the Washington Post, an essay. A blog mm-hmm. post, a provocation, I don't know what you want to call it. I write for the Post. I write for the Washington Free Beacon, where I'm executive editor, and I kind of freelance all over the place doing my critic thing.
Mm-hmm. Now, how did you get into doing critiques? Now, you focused on movies, but of course, you know, there are critics of books and there are critics of art, but you focus on the movies primarily. How did you get into that?
Sure. You know, this is going to sound really terrible, but it was because I was bored. I was working at the Weekly Standard at the time. It was like 2005, 2006. And the Weekly Standard is a great place to work insofar as you have kind of a lot of leeway on what you're doing. Assuming you're getting, you know, your regular work done, you can kind of write whatever you want. As long as you have some skill and a patient editor. Frankly, I had gotten to the kind of point where I just wasn't doing very much. I wasn't doing very much with my time. One day I randomly got an invitation to an early screening of, I can't even remember what it was. Miami Vice or something. I didn't actually write about it for the website or anything afterwards, but I kind of just got the bug to start you know, writing about film. Again, I'd written about I took a bunch of, you know, film history, film as an art form classes in college, and had always really enjoyed it, and, you know, kind of kept that in my back pocket.
You didn't just snooze through those. Those weren't just an easy A for you that you were actually.
No, I would say those were actually the classes I paid the most attention to through my last 2 years of college. Frankly, I had kind of burnt out on schooling after, you know, 15 years of,
As one does.
I was just like, but movies are great. So anyway, I started writing. I think DVD reviews, like what's new in on DVD shelves, that sort of thing. Because I didn't want to step on the turf of our, at the time, the and still actually regular critic at the Weekly Standard, John Podhoretz. I didn't want to impinge on his territory. So just started writing, you know, kind of DVD reviews and movie reviews and the occasional, you know, and book reviews and stuff, all the other stuff I was writing. The editor at the Washington Times, who ran the style/culture section, was reading my stuff and said, "Hey, do you want to do some freelance movie reviews for me?" I said, "Sure." And, like 2 months later, I'd been hired as one of the full-time critics there. And that lasted for about 15 months, before I got laid off. The Washington Times went through one of its periodic series of, layoffs. Long story short, a few years later, I'm at the Free Beacon and once again, just kind of bored and, didn't have I had a ton to do here, but, I wasn't doing very much writing. So I picked it up again and I don't know, three plus years now. Writing reviews. Well,
now if I recall, at this time, were you the managing editor at the Free Beacon?
Yes. So
you had power.
Yes, I had power over not just writers, but also myself. Nobody could really tell me. The only person who could tell me, "No, you can't do that," was Matthew Continetti, our editor in chief. He was not interested in, frankly, telling me not to do that. He figured it was probably easier just to let me do, you know, whatever it is I wanted. He's right too. I can be, you know, very petulant and sullen when I don't get my way. So the only thing worse than,
so kind of like Neil. Than,
right. The only thing worse than an aggressive, angry Sonny is a petulant, sullen Sonny.
Well, it's to all our benefit that that nobody stood in your way as you went about writing movie critiques.
Yeah, that must be a really boring segment of the podcast. I'm sorry for like the 4 minute resume reading.
Well, no, see what that does, Sonny, is for our listeners, it establishes that you have a little bit of expertise in the subject which we're discussing. It lets them know that, hey, this guy knows more than I do, and I should pay attention.
Yes. So
basically puts the listener in their place, as
good.
It were. Yeah.
Garbage.
So that kind of brings us to the discussion of the larger discussion of the role of the critic. You know, it's like everybody has an opinion about something. You ask anybody on the street and they might have an opinion, informed or not. Well, what makes one man's opinion carry more weight than another's, especially when we're talking about cultural critique and that sort of thing?
You know, I mean, look, I think the most important thing for critics is it's not just to have a point of view, right? It's also to have a kind of base level of knowledge. Like, you know, it's not just enough to say, the new Blair Witch movie is bad. Right, it's to discuss the ways in which found footage have kind of permeated the culture. You know, discussing how the film techniques have kind of evolved or metastasized or mm-hmm. you know that sort of thing. And the thing that's always very frustrating. To me is when someone says, "Well, what's your favorite movie?" And I don't know how to answer that because it kind of depends on the day of the week or you know what I'm in the mood to watch, right? Because like it's not so much having a favorite, it's not so much saying this is good or this is bad, it's saying why is this good, why is this bad? And hopefully I help people get a sense of that in my writing. I would say sometimes I'm more successful than others, but
yes, sometimes you are more successful than others. No, I'm just kidding. I enjoy reading your reviews. I rely upon you almost exclusively for my movie reviews, Sonny. And I don't know if that's a good thing or a bad thing, but I do enjoy them. You do a great job of bringing that knowledge to bear, like you say. Because I think that is sort of the important thing that distinguishes a critic from just some guy on moviepoopshoot.com or whatever.
That's a good Kevin Smith reference. I understand that's a good Kevin Smith reference because I've seen altogether too many Kevin Smith
movies. Isn't that a great reference? That was an amazing reference.
which really limit, like, frankly, my head is so full of useless Kevin Smith crap. That I feel ashamed every time he puts out a terrible new movie.
I know.
Oh, it's horrible,
just,
isn't
there's
it?
Just such a, there's such a baseline of knowledge that is going to waste in my head. That, it's really awful.
Jay and Silent Bob Strike Back, I mean, it was just an amazing film all around. It really tied everything together, I think.
I would say, I think Clerks 2 was actually kind of underrated as like a bow on the View Askew cinematic universe. Really one of the like original expanded universe. Has anybody written this piece that like the original expanded universe is really like Clerks, Mallrats, Chasing Amy, that kind of series of films?
No, I don't think anyone has.
I mean, like Clerks 2 is like a direct sequel, and it's kind of the only one of those films that's a direct sequel. I mean, like they kind of exist. Anyway, random thoughts. Sorry.
But they all kind of exist in the
same. That's what we live for.
Yeah, but there are things that tie them all together. You know,
right?
The names of malls and places where they go and stuff. So it's funny. There's different characters in different movies, but they're all kind of connected in a strange way. So I get what you're talking about. Hey, let me ask you this, Sonny. You said you've kind of got a little bit of freedom there. Now, I mean, are you like the Leonard Maltin type that goes or Roger Ebert that sees like, you know, 50 movies a week? Or are you basically saying,
no,
I want to see this one, I want to see that one, I don't want to see that, and then you get to pick and choose?
No, I so when I was at the Washington Times, I was like a 4 to 5 movie a week critic. I was seeing, you know, generally 2 or 3 movies in the theater, and then I would watch 1 or 2 movies at my desk. And I was writing, in an average week, I was writing probably 3 reviews, some weeks 2, some weeks 4, some weeks just 1. But I was seeing a lot of movies. I was seeing like 200 movies a year. And frankly, like, you know, doing that job for about 18 months almost burned me out on movies. Owen Gleiberman in his memoir, which is very good, people should check it out if you're interested in like learning what the life of a film critic is like. Owen Gleiberman used to be the film critic for Entertainment Weekly and now writes for, I believe, Variety. You know, he talks about how like, you know, some film critics complain about having to see tons of movies and, you know, they're whiners and idiots because this is the greatest job in the world. And he's right. It is a fantastic job. And the idea of complaining about going to see movies for free, you know, 4 times a week, sounds really awful and ridiculous, but it actually is very mentally draining, especially because you're seeing, you know, you're seeing the real dregs in addition to the real great cinema. It's not like you can just say, oh, I'm only going to go see the new Paul Thomas Anderson movie. I'm only going to see, you know, the new Wes Anderson movie. I'm only going to see the movies by people named Anderson. I kind of prefer what I do now, which is just watch. I pick whatever either the biggest or the best movie every week is, and I write about that. And it is like better for my own sanity. It's frankly better for my marriage. It allows me to spend a little more time with each movie, right? Like instead of, you know, spending 4 or 5 hours writing 300 or 400 words about 4 different movies, you know, sitting down and actually writing 700, 800 thought out, words about a film, kind of placing it in the context of the moment, in the context of the careers of the people involved, et cetera, is a more satisfying and I think more interesting form of writing.
Yeah. Cause I was going to say, you'd have to see a lot of junk with, and that's what I was thinking is like, that's what I wanted to find out is like, it would probably get exhausting if you've just got to see 5 or 6 movies a week and let's say 3 of them are garbage. That must be.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I mean,
so.
Yeah. It's just, and again, it's the sort of thing that frankly sounds kind of lame to complain about. You know, a terrible movie is going to be an hour and a half to 2 hours. You know, it's not like you're afflicted with pox or anything. But like it really is kind of draining to find. I am not the sort of critic who really enjoys writing like mean, brutal reviews. So like finding something, you know, kind of non-caustic to say about everything that you see can be very, very taxing.
Well, because that's what it really means when you go to see these bad films is, as a critic, you owe it to your audience to remain actively engaged with this piece of crap that you're sitting through.
Yeah.
You know, so that you can give them that informed opinion and bring some baseline of knowledge to bear upon it and tell them why it's not worth their $8 to $10, or 12 or 15, depending on which market you happen to be in.
Yeah.
But so I can see that being an incredible amount of work. So,
yeah, I mean, honestly, it's the world's smallest violin plays, I know.
Well, it's not like when, say, Jay or I turn on Netflix and I can take a chance on something like, you know, Cannibal Holocaust, for instance, and I can sort of tune out if I feel like I don't have to be paying attention and analyzing exactly what this guy is doing with the technique and, you know, cinema verite, et cetera, et cetera. I don't have to be thinking about all that. I can just report to people later on, oh yeah, it's crappy. So Sonny, I wanted to touch briefly on the subject of subjectivity and objectivity, since we've kind of been discussing what makes a movie bad and what makes a movie good. I mean, is critique entirely subjective, or are there like minimum standards, you know, below which a piece of work can be called objectively bad, a bad movie, a bad book, blah, blah, blah?
Sure. Well, it is an interesting question, and I want to be careful how I answer it, because, you know, one of the big things in the whole Gamergate fight, right, was the gamers who said, we don't like your reviews because they're too political. You need to write objective reviews. And that criticism of gaming reviewing never really made any sense to me, insofar as like what these people are saying is like they just want numbers. The gameplay was a 7. The storyline was a 9. The punching mechanics, you know, were an A+, etc. That sort of thing, that's not really criticism in any real sense. That's like a manual review, or like I don't actually even understand kind of how that kind of works intellectually.
I think a tech manual is probably the best
the
best comparison.
Yeah, it's just kind of hard to imagine. So like the idea that you can have an objective review of a work of art, I think, is false. Now, the way what you can do, and what you should do, frankly, as a film critic, this is something Matt Zoller-Seitz, who is now the chief critic or the editor in chief over at RogerEbert.com, kind of harps on constantly, is if you're writing about film, take some time to actually consider the visual way in which the storytelling works, right? Think about the way that the film is put together. Think about how it's edited. Think about how the camera works. Think about how the stunts are executed. There was a great video a few years back called, I think it was called Chaos Cinema. And it was just like kind of breaking down the ways in which the big kind of action sequence in The Dark Knight, and with the Joker in the rig, he's driving the truck and Batman's in the tumbler, and how that scene didn't actually make any sense visually because of the way it was cut, the way it was edited, the way action moved one way of the screen then the other, and the way the cameras kind of flipped. And it was actually, I love The Dark Knight. I think it's a great film. I think it's a 4-star film. I have no objections to it, but I think that is a very good way of looking at the objective kind of components of filmmaking and how they can or cannot work. There was another piece that somebody did, another video essay that somebody did looking at like the way Michael Bay's visual style works and kind of comparing him to his competitors slash copycats like Peter Berg and some others. You know, the reason that Michael Bay's films, like, set aside the slapdash editing and the like constant cuts and the explosions and the Victoria's Secret models, like, just if you just look at the way he kind of frames his big sweeping action shots, and the way he places actors in the foreground, steady objects in the background like light poles or ships or something, and then motion in the sky to create this kind of parallax view where everything is in motion and everything seems super dramatic, you know, compared to the people who don't do that, and the effect doesn't work and it looks flat and terrible. You know, these are things that you pick up by watching, by reading criticism, by watching video essays, and you can kind of translate that for regular audience members, right? Like, the goal of the critic is to help the audience understand what they've seen, to help them understand why what they've seen is good or why it's bad, to help them discuss the ways in which movies work or don't work. You know, every good piece of criticism has one original insight in it. That's my general rule for criticism. If you can just get one original idea in front of people, then, you know, the 800 words that surround that idea are worth it.
Interesting.
Did I answer your question? I'm sorry. I went off on a tangent.
No, I believe that you did answer my question very adroitly, sir. Thank you. Which it actually kind of made me think of another question, somewhat related, you know, to the art world, and, you know, a lot of filmmakers, especially experimental filmmakers, they receive some critical accolades, even though to the layman their output may be somewhat incomprehensible or just boring or what have you. But I was wondering if you would agree that perhaps whether this is necessary in film, this the way that Picasso, for instance, was a very accomplished artist capturing realistic form and light and that sort of thing before he began experimenting with cubism and you know, more abstract impressionism. To be able to deconstruct the medium, you have to have a rudimentary grasp of it and technical skill. Is that the same in film, or can anybody just go out there and, you know, with a camcorder and stumble onto making an avant-garde film?
I think the answer to that is you do have to have, it depends on the sort of film you want to make, right? Like we were discussing Kevin Smith earlier, and I think mm-hmm. Kevin Smith is like the furthest thing in the world from a technically accomplished filmmaker. You know, it's a lot of shot reverse shot talking. You know, I remember listening to the Mallrats commentary track on the DVD release of that film, and he gets very excited because at one point they have an actual tracking shot on like rail that had been laid down. It's like it's the sort of thing that you see in a movie a million times and you never really think about, but like here's an actual, you know, technical thing he's done for the first time in his second movie, like halfway through it. So I think if you are trying to make a movie that has a real kind of visual panache, a real kind of coherent piece of visual storytelling, there you do need some sort of baseline rudimentary knowledge of the filmmaking process. Now, you don't necessarily have to get that at film school. You can get it by, you know, like Quentin Tarantino, I don't think went to film school. You know, he didn't, you don't need to like actually sit there and learn from professors how to do this thing. But I do think you need kind of a rudimentary knowledge of how the camera works and how that translates to the world
mm-hmm.
In order to really be a great filmmaker.
Well, it's like you were saying about Michael Bay's movies, you know, his shots have composition to them, you know, and it's an explicit thing. He has a certain style, and that's not something that you just kind of stumble upon. He's developed that style, and it's been a very popular style of film. So Michael Bay is that rare artistic genius who has been able to also make billion-dollar movies.
Yeah, I mean, you know, I'm not 100% sure I would go as far. I would say. I mean, he's.
I'm being mildly ridiculous.
I'm tripping over myself here because I do think I kind of both agree with the argument that Michael Bay is a total vulgarian and like doesn't understand basic cinematic language. But I also think he has a unique visual style that people are drawn to. That is, I mean, he is an auteur in the truest sense of the word, and he is like both the best and the worst case for the auteur theory. That like that he makes big studio films with his own visual stamp, and like pursuing his own kind of ideological and artistic interests within the studio system. Like he is an auteur. So like whether or not that is a good or a bad thing kind of depends on how you feel about, you know, auteur theory.
I think he had a chance to bring his style to a much more serious type of film with 13 Hours, and I thought he did a very good job. I thought the movie was a lot better than what the critics were saying about it, because I think maybe you correct me if I'm wrong, it's like some people wanted to hate it because it was Michael Bay directing it.
Yeah. No, I think that is generally true of Michael Bay's work. I don't even know that it was necessarily because it was Michael Bay doing the Benghazi movie. I think it was just, you know, people don't really like his style, which I understand. I get it. I understand that people don't really like that kind of frenetic, super quick cut style. But I thought 13 Hours was a very effective movie. I think it's not quite as good as, say, Black Hawk Down, but it was for what it was, it was a very effective piece of filmmaking.
Before we wrap up our discussion of the role of the critic, I wanted to ask you who some of your role models are in your work as a critic. Who do you read currently, or who did you grow up reading that really inspired you, inspired your style and your approach to movies?
Well, that's an interesting question. I would say probably my favorite film critic working today, and one of the first film criticism collections I ever actually bought was The New Yorker's Anthony Lane, who has like kind of a perfect mix of snarky and also like straightforward writing and opinions. You know, the great thing about Amazon is that it has made it really easy to track down old collections of film criticism. This is like the thing I love the most about Amazon. There are a couple of really good old writers out. I mean, like obviously you have your Pauline Kael's and your classic writers of that sort. I really like John Simon. He was a longtime critic for National Review, but also wrote elsewhere. Wrote a lot of theater criticism too, which I don't read as much of, because I am a vulgar type who would never set foot in the legitimate theater. Who else do I really like? Like Matt Zollersites, I think his writing is very good. Stanley Kaufman, the longtime film critic for The New Republic, who died a couple years back. I think Chris Hughes killed him. He is his writings from the 1960s and 1950s and 1970s are all very good if you're into kind of that period of filmmaking.
Yeah, I have to, Anthony Lane, I have to read this because I went to Amazon and looked. And here's a snippet from his review of Con Air. Neil, you'll appreciate this one. Advance word on Con Air said it was all about an airplane with an unusually dangerous and potentially lethal load. Big deal. You should try the lunches they serve out of Newark. Compared with the chicken napalm I ate on my last flight, the men in Con Air are about as dangerous as balloons.
Exactly.
Like that.
he's got a very caustic style. But he also let me see if I can actually pull it up right now. His review of the Robert De Niro film Ronin,
great movie,
starts off with a great line that is something like, at a certain point in Ronin, when Robert De Niro popped out of the top of an Audi S300 with a rocket launcher on his shoulders, I realized that I was having a very good time in the movie theater. Something like that. He has this kind of pinpoint wit that I greatly enjoy. Oh, here it is. I found it actually from his collection. As Robert De Niro stood up on the front seat of his speeding black Audi and poked the upper half of his body through the sunroof, the better to rest the rocket launcher on his shoulder and aim it at the car in front, I arrived at the mature conclusion that Ronin was, all things considered, a rather enjoyable film.
Nicely understated.
That's good. Well, Sonny, you've been asked the question, what's your favorite movie? But and make it a little easier for you. It's like, what is a movie that you can kind of just always watch if it's on? I mean, we've heard about this, about like, The Godfather and Shawshank Redemption. Is there something that, you've seen it 100 times and you don't care if it's on, you'll watch it again? It doesn't necessarily have to be a favorite, but just one out of whatever. It doesn't matter. Just pick one.
I mean, there are a lot of choices, I guess, but if I was just going to pick one, let's go with Raising Arizona. How about that? Raising Arizona. Very funny.
Very funny.
Like, strangely kind of underrated in the Coen brothers canon, I think.
I agree. You can name a couple others. You don't have to pick just one.
another one that I've always thought is kind of underrated, is Scorsese's Casino. Which, like, all right, I understand that it's basically Goodfellas Redux. I can live with that. Every time I turn it on, I watch for, like, an hour. I mean, just, like, totally, I basically anywhere in the film, I turn it on, and it's, I'm good to go.
Yeah, it's pretty interesting.
I literally can't distinguish between those two movies. I am trying to, right now, picture a scene from Casino and a scene from Goodfellas, and all I can think of is, I think it's Goodfellas.
Ray Liotta's in Goodfellas. Yeah. He's not in Casino. So if Ray Liotta's in your image, then it's probably Goodfellas.
Yeah, it's Goodfellas. Yeah, there you go. Otherwise, they're pretty much, and Sharon Stone is in Casino. So there you can just...
Sharon Stone and James Wood. James Woods, who's I was recently going through an Oliver Stone kick, getting ready to write about Snowden, and I saw an early Oliver Stone's like third picture, but like the first one he considers to be an Oliver Stone film called Salvador, which stars James Woods,
Jim Belushi
James Woods and Jim Belushi as basically American journalists running around through South America during the Central America during the Death Squad years. It's strangely entertaining for a movie about the horrors of American-fueled imperialism.
Yeah, it was good. And he play in Casino. He plays the role of a dirtbag to like perfection.
Yeah,
so it's like even the hair. You want to smack the guy. So, all right. So,
Jay, what's your movie that you can watch anytime?
It doesn't matter that there is a twist at the end, The Usual Suspects is something that I can always just kind of enjoy. It's just fun to watch. Yeah,
That's a good one.
Benicio del Toro in that is terrific. And if you've listened, it was funny because when they originally were thinking about the character, they were talking about an older guy like Harry Dean Stanton, who if you know who he is, that's who they were considering for it. And so when they brought Benicio in, he just kind of took it in his own direction. And one of the funniest thing was he was saying stuff that people couldn't understand. And so they were like, we can't understand what he's saying. And so who's the director?
Bryan Singer.
Bryan Singer was just basically would tell him, well, just, you know, if you can't understand him, just ask what he says. And there's a part in the scene when they're in the jail and he says something about who stole the truck and somebody couldn't understand. He's like, what did you say? And basically that was real because he couldn't understand what he was saying. So little things like that, when you learn about it in the background, just kind of makes it even more fun when you're watching it. And I recently came across a thing where there was a guy at the restaurant in the beginning, one of the French guys, you barely saw him, and it just brought out the whole entire nerd factor in me that I recognized him from an episode of Seinfeld. And I was like, shit, I got to get out more. What about you, Neil?
Predator.
Predator or Predator 2?
No, just Predator, the first one. I think it speaks for itself there. I mean, if you can't just pick up and watch Predator at literally any moment in that film, I don't know what to tell you. Okay. I mean, yeah. I'll watch the last 5 minutes. I'll watch the entire thing. It doesn't matter.
Predator is one of those movies I consider like to fall into the category of a perfect movie, not like necessarily a 4-star film, not necessarily like high art, but the sort of movie that it works so perfectly within its own logical framework.
Yes.
And is so propulsive and, like, frankly, just does the job that it's supposed to do, which mm-hmm. is be a high concept, entertaining action film that it is in a very limited sort of way, very perfect.
I mean, it literally never slows down enough to get boring. It just moves from one element to the next. It hits all of it. It's got the horror notes. It's got the action. It's got everything that you could want in a movie. And it does, like you say, it's a perfect movie in its own logical framework. So speaking of other perfect movies, I think we should discuss Die Hard.
Oh.
Gentlemen. The question before the house, is Die Hard a Christmas movie? And we have asked numerous guests of varying degrees of experience and expertise this very question. And I will say that most of our guests have answered in the affirmative, saying that, yes, Die Hard is a Christmas movie. However, none of our guests heretofore have been experts in the field of movies and movie reviews. So I must ask, Mr. Bunch, your position on this film, and then we will give Jay a chance to make his case for the affirmative. So, Mr. Bunch, please. Is Die Hard?
The answer is no. The answer is no. Die Hard is not a Christmas movie. Christmas is not integral to the plot of Die Hard. There are many Christmas themed jokes, and there are many nods to Christmas. But the simple fact of the matter is that Christmas is not in any way integral to the very kind of bare bones plot of the film. Indeed, I think it would have actually made more sense as a 4th of July movie, frankly. I think it would have been a much better, more coherent film were it to take place during Independence Day. But, combined with the fact that this is a movie that was released in the dead of the summer blockbuster season, this is a summer blockbuster movie. It is also a perfect film. It is like totally propulsive and perfectly acted and has like one of the great on-screen villains and all that good stuff. It's just not a Christmas movie.
Mr. Caruso, your rebuttal.
Okay. So, first we'll start with the release date because people say it's released in July that it can't be a Christmas movie. One of the great Christmas movies of all time, Miracle on 34th Street, was actually released on May 2nd, 1947. So, to say that the release date is part of the reason why it can't be a Christmas movie is this doesn't hold water. If you're going to say that, then you're going to say Miracle on 34th Street is not a Christmas movie. It's possible to say that. The other part is, this is the argument that everybody says, that Christmas is not integral to the plot of the movie. And it is. If you say, okay, we should have done this on July 4th, Independence Day. Now, first of all, a Japanese-owned company probably wouldn't be allowing, wouldn't be having a party in a building that's pretty much empty on July 4th. Second of all, this was Christmas Eve, so everybody, you know, there was nobody in the building except for that party. Everyone had gone home. There was nobody around. Everything was closed. That was the reason why the terrorists chose that particular night to do it, because they knew nobody was going to be around. The only reason why John McClane was in Los Angeles was because it was Christmas. He was going out there to visit his family during Christmas to try and reconcile with his wife. Nobody goes to reconcile with their wife on July 4th. It just doesn't happen that way. So Christmas is actually very integral to the plot, because they wouldn't have been able to perform this kind of robbery at any other time. There would have just been too many people around. It would have been too messy, and they wouldn't have been able to pull it off. So you take that combined with all of the Christmas elements, and it is a Christmas movie.
Thank you, Jay. But I will say this. First principles, Caruso. Simplicity. Read Marcus Aurelius. Of each particular thing, ask, what is it in itself? What is its nature? What does he do, this McClane, you see? He kills terrorists, Jay. Die Hard is not a film about Christmas. It is not intimately tied to Christmas. It is a film about killing terrorists. The relationship with his wife is one that is also incidental. Okay, he who cares if they were to get back together at the end of the movie? The movie's not about that. That is what we call a plot device. It is a contrivance of the plot. The date of the film is also a contrivance of the plot. And when you are contriving plots, you can contrive them to be whatever you wish. So if the filmmakers had said it during the July 4th holiday, they would have contrived a way to make it work. Christmas is not essential. It is incidental.
I just want to point out that the argument that the Japanese company would not have people out on July 4th holds no water. It would actually make it better. Look at this culture clash. The Japanese, they're having Americans to celebrate the nationalist holiday of July 4th, because that is what the Japanese would do. They want to have people out to the big skyscraper so they can see the fireworks that are going to be over Los Angeles. But, you know, we're going to have some fireworks of our own, you know.
Precisely.
On the roof, explosions, etc. See, and like explosions on the roof, fireworks. I mean, it all comes together.
It truly does, Mr. Caruso. Anyway. I will give you one final response, and then I think we will let the listeners decide the matter once and for all.
Okay. You guys are wrong, and I'm right. I'll quote a movie. You guys see if you can pick up it. Everything that guy just said is bullshit. Sonny knows what it's from.
Well, that is a well-reasoned response, which I'm sure will convince many people.
And by the way, for anybody that doesn't know, it's from my cousin Vinny. It was his opening argument in a murder case.
Oh, that's the one with the guy from Goodfellas again.
Yeah, Joe Pesci.
Yeah, that one.
Yeah,
and Home Alone.
The guy from Goodfellas. What? And the guy from Casino.
Yeah, I assume that My Cousin Vinny is a great Christmas movie, too.
They discover tolerance for differing cultures in that film, which seems vaguely Christmassy.
Yeah, they did. He started to enjoy eating grits, and not instant grits. No self-respecting Southerner would eat instant grits.
If that doesn't say Christmas magic, I don't know what does. Sonny, could you tell the listeners where they can find you again?
I am the executive editor of the Washington Free Beacon. That's freebeacon.com. I'm at Twitter at Sonny Bunch, SONNYBUNCH. I assume Sonny with a U is like a porn star, Sonny Bunch, or possibly stripper. I'm on Twitter. Go to Twitter. That's where I am.
And he is always a delight to interact with on Twitter, and has many friendly things to say. If you were to send him your unsolicited opinion, I'm sure he would appreciate it on any subject, really.
Yes.
But we do appreciate you taking the time to be with us and explain a little bit about what you do.
Yeah.
Hopefully we can have you on again, maybe just to talk movies sometime.
Yeah, totally.
We'll do that. Talk about our favorite Christmas movies. We'll have this argument again.
Well, we should wait till July to do it.
Or May 2nd. All right. Thanks again, Sonny. Appreciate you being on. My name is Jay Caruso. And again, if you guys like this, go out there, subscribe. Leave us a review. We always like that. And for Neil Dewing, we will see you next time here on The Fifth Estate.